Now that the tombs were in ruin, and their priestess forsworn forever, now he didn't need her, and went away where she could not follow. He would not stay with her. He had fooled her, and would leave her desolate. She reached down, and with one swift gesture plucked from his belt the little steel dagger she had given him. He moved no more than a robbed statue. The dagger blade was only 4 inches long, sharp on one side. It was the miniature of a sacrificial knife. It was part of the garments of the priestess of the tombs, who must wear it along with the ring of keys, and a belt of horsehair, and other items, some of which had no known purpose. She had never used the dagger for anything, except that in one of the dances performed at dark of the moon, she would throw and catch it before the throne. She had liked that dance. It was a wild one, with no music but the drumming of her own feet. She had used to cut her fingers, practicing it, till she got the trick of catching the knife handle every time. The little blade was sharp enough to cut a finger to the bone, or to cut the arteries of a throat. She would serve her masters still, though they had betrayed her and forsaken her. They would guide and drive her hand in the last act of darkness. They would accept the sacrifice. She turned upon the man, the knife held back in her right hand behind her hip. As she did so, he raised his face slowly and looked at her. He had the look of one come from a long way off, one who has seen terrible things. His face was calm, but full of pain. As he gazed up at her and seemed to see her more and more clearly, his expression cleared. At last he said, "Tanar," as if in greeting, and reached up his hand to touch the band of pierced and carven silver on her wrist. He did this as if reassuring himself, trustingly. He did not pay attention to the dagger in her hand. He looked away at the waves, which heaved deep over the rocks below, and said with effort, "It's time. Time we were going." At the sound of his voice, the fury left her. She was afraid. "You'll leave them behind, Tanar. You're going free now," he said, getting up with sudden vigor. He stretched and belted his cloak tight again. "Give me a hand with the boat. She's up on logs for rollers. That's it. Push. Again. They're there enough. Now, be ready to hop in when I say hop. This is a tricky place to launch from. Once more. There. In you go." And leaping in after her, he caught her as she overbalanced, sat her down in the bottom of the boat, braced his legs wide, and standing to the oars, sent the boat shooting out on an ebb wave over the rocks, out past the roaring, foam-drenched head of the cape, and so to sea. He shipped the oars when they were well away from shoal water, and stepped the mast. The boat looked very small, now that she was inside it, and the sea was outside it. He put up the sail. All the gear had a look of long, hard use, though the dull red sail was patched with great care, and the boat was as clean and trim as could be. They were like their master. They had gone far and had not been treated gently. "Now," he said, "now we're away. Now we're clear. We're clean gone, Tanar. Do you feel it?" She did feel it. A dark hand had let go its lifelong hold upon her heart. But she did not feel joy as she had in the mountains. She put her head down in her arms and cried, and her cheeks were salt and wet. She cried for the waste of her years in bondage to a useless evil. She wept in pain because she was free. What she had begun to learn was the weight of liberty. Freedom is a heavy load, a great and strange burden for the spirit to undertake. It is not easy. It is not a gift given, but a choice made. And the choice may be a hard one. The road goes upward towards the light, but the laden traveler may never reach the end of it. Ged let her cry, and said no word of comfort. Nor, when she was done with tears, and sat looking back towards the low blue land of Atuan, did he speak. His face was stern and alert, as if he were alone. He saw to the sail and the steering, quick and silent, looking always ahead. In the afternoon, he pointed rightward of the sun, towards which they now sailed. "That is Karego'at," he said, and Tanar, following his gesture, saw the distant loom of hills like clouds, the great island of the God King. Atuan was out of sight behind them. Her heart was very heavy. The sun beat in her eyes like a hammer of gold. Supper was dry bread and dried smoked fish, which tasted vile to Tanar, and water from the boat's cask, which Ged had filled at a stream on Cloud Cape beach the evening before. The winter night came down soon and cold upon the sea. Far off to northward, they saw for a while the tiny glitter of lights, yellow firelight in distant villages on the shores of Karego'at. These vanished in a haze that rose up from the ocean, and they were alone.